So that's on page 681 at the very bottom right-hand side, only just on that page. We're going to read from 3 verse 6 to 4 verse 7. And we join it where she is singing to him. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior inlaid with love. Daughters of Jerusalem, come out and look, you daughters of Zion. Look on King Solomon wearing a crown, the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. How beautiful you are, he sings, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from the hills of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn, coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with courses of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. You are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no flaw in you. We've been reading about a wedding, and we're going to sing about Jesus, who is our King and who is also a bridegroom. So I've put that down next to you and keep it open, because we'll have another reading in a moment on the same page. But please stand now. We're going to sing Who Am I?
So continuing straight on from the last reading, page 682, beginning at verse 8. He sings, come with me from Lebanon, my bride, come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Sinir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's dens and the mountain haunts of leopards. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume more than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates, with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water, streaming down from Lebanon. She sings, awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden, that its fragrance may spread everywhere. Let my beloved come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. He sings, I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I've drunk my wine and my milk. Friends sing, eat, friends, and drink. Drink your fill of love.
Well, please keep that open in front of you. We're going to look at that together. It'd be great if you've got it there so that you can look at it with me. And we're thinking about this question at the moment. What is sex about? Plenty of people have a very materialistic view of the world. They think that nothing is real unless it's materialistic, unless it's a physical thing, something you can find and research with science. And in their thinking, there's no room for people to have a soul or a spirit. There's no place for God or anything supernatural. And people like that, really, they have to answer that question in only one way. They have to say that sex is just a purely physical, bodily urge. Built into our bodies, it's there to make sure that we reproduce and that the human race continues. And if that is the case, if that is all it is, then surely, well, now that we've discovered contraception and we know how to do that, then surely anything goes. So long as you have two consenting adults, they would say there is no moral issue. There's no real meaning to any of this. After all, if you're hungry, you eat a burger. If you're thirsty, you drink a Coke. They would say if you're turned on, then have sex. It's a kind of fast food version of relationships. It's devalued. It's casual. It's cheap. It's disposable. It's instant. It has no lasting value or significance. You have too much, you don't feel so good afterwards. Fast food. I'm going to show a few lyrics from a song by Ed Sheeran. We're just going to listen to it. And maybe you could read them for a few moments and have a think about what they say about our culture's view of sex.
A club isn't the best place to find the lovers, so the bar is where I go. Me and my friends sat at the table doing shots, tripping fast, and then we talk slow. Come over and start up a conversation with just me, and trust me, I'll give it a chance. Now take my hand, stop, and the man on the jukebox.
Well, I think you can see that it's a casual relationship. It's a physical relationship, the way he tells the story. It comes about very quickly. And yet, even from a song like that, you can sense that he realizes there's something more to it than that. There's something more intimate and personal about those lyrics. He's not just saying that her body is a great shape, he's saying that he's in love with that shape because it's the shape of her. And he says, my heart is falling too. People may say that sex has no meaning, and they may think that that is the case, but I suspect most people can tell there is more to it than that. They sense that something much deeper is really going on. Well, how does the Bible answer that question? What is sex about? We've been looking at a song in the Bible that is all about that question. We've chosen to look at it in five parts. I mean, songs, you know, you can't pin them down. They're deliberately vague. That helps us, I think, to feel them and to relate to them and feel the mood. But just to help us, we've looked at it in these five sections. The first part about attraction. Will they, won't they? Will he feel the same way that she feels? How is she ever going to meet him? That sort of thing. In the second part, we heard a song about longing. He's winning her over. She's saying yes, but there's a waiting. There's delay. That's not easy. Today's reading is about consummation, especially chapter 5, verse 1. Now, there are actually, that verse, chapter 5, verse 1, is right in the middle. I'm going to read it because you're all reading it now. It's not explicit, chapter 5, verse 1, but I think it's what it's about. I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I've drunk my wine and my milk. Eat, friends, and drink your fill of love. Now, songs, it's hard to know how physical the relationship is sometimes in this song, but I think most people agree that that is talking about the consummation of their relationship. And it's right in the middle of the song, very literally. There are 111 verses before it. There are 111 verses after it. That isn't a coincidence. It's quite a common thing in songs and poems from that time, from that place, that what was in the centre would be the important thing. And the whole thing would be arranged. So the heart and centre of the song, the big theme of the song, it's about sex. And what is this song saying that sex is about? Well, three things. In God's wisdom, sex is about three things. Let's look at them. Firstly, it's about beauty. It's about beauty. And the first part of our reading earlier We saw that there was a majestic groom being sung about in chapter 3, verse 6 to 11, the end of chapter 3. There was a beautiful bride being sung about in chapter 4, verses 1 to 7. She sings about him. Then he sings about her. She imagines King Solomon's carriage arriving in power and majesty on the day of his wedding. So let's look back at that, back over the page at the bottom of page 681. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. Now, why is she singing about King Solomon? Some people say, well, this whole song might be Solomon writing about his own love life. I think that's very unlikely. Other parts of the song sound like it's about a poor country couple, people who do hard manual work and who are outdoors. Near the end of the song, Solomon gets mentioned again, but not in a good way. The love of this couple is contrasted to Solomon. Solomon's love is not so good. Theirs is much better. And in fact, Solomon's love life was famously bad. He had many wives and concubines. That is what led him astray from God. It messed up the kingdom. It is hard to imagine they would have kept a song about his love life and said, look, here's a wonderful testimony about how great love can be. I just can't imagine how that would have happened. So why then is his wedding being mentioned here? Well, because it's a song, it's a poem. And everyone loves a royal wedding. We've had a few royal weddings in recent years. The dress gets imitated and appears in fashion magazines and influences others. The music that they choose for their wedding sets off a trend, and other people choose it for their weddings. Actually, on the day of this particular wedding, I happened to be taking another wedding. They'd already booked the date first. They chose their reading first. It happened to be the same reading from Song of Songs that Harry and Meghan chose. And I remember one of the things that we were saying that day is that for all of us at that wedding, that was the big wedding of the day. You know, there was this other famous wedding that lots of people were watching on TV, but the big wedding for them was between the two of them. Of course it was. It was their royal wedding. And I wonder if this girl, as she gets married, is calling her young female friends and saying, look, this is who he is to me. This is my day. He may be a poor shepherd boy. Maybe I work out in the vineyards, but this is a royal wedding. And to me, he's King Solomon arriving for our wedding. So if we read on from verse 9, King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold, its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior inlaid with love. Daughters of Jerusalem, come out and look, you daughters of Zion. Look on King Solomon wearing a crown, the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. She's singing that their marriage couldn't be more precious, even if he were to arrive in a royal carriage made of gold and silver. Their marriage would still be more precious than that. Their wedding carriage is inlaid with something that is far better than the most expensive purple cloth. It's inlaid with love, she says. She sings about him, a majestic groom. He sings about her, a beautiful bride. That's the beginning of chapter 4. And it starts in verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. First, he sings about her eyes. Something very intimate about gazing into someone's eyes. Then he sings about her hair. Men soon discover in a relationship that you are supposed to notice when her hair changes. And when she's done something to it. There's usually a very good clue. She's usually staring at you, looking a bit irritated and waiting for you to say something. And you're thinking, why is she irritated with me? And then you realize. And you're meant to notice, you're meant to say something. You're meant to say something positive, affirming, complimentary. I don't recommend these words. I don't think they'd be the right words to say. chapter 4, verse 1. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from the hills of Gilead. I really love your haircut. It's really goatee. I can't see that working very well. It's not a good idea. But I guess at the time, it would have been heard as something really nice to say. I was trying to figure out why. I can remember in the summer, walking along the south coast, and it was a really nice view. You could see a long way, and I saw something in the distance. It was so far away, and my sight isn't brilliant. I couldn't quite work out what it was, but there was a kind of pattern streaming down the hill in waves. And as we got a bit closer, I realised it must be a flock of sheep. It must be, there was a shepherd there. There was a sheepdog, and it was guiding these sheep through various, and they were all following each other, and it's just like a flowing pattern. Now, I guess this couple spent a lot of time outside with their sheep and their goats, and that sort of flowing, streaming pattern in the distance is something they're used to seeing. He's saying that her hair flows, it shimmers, it streams down her, and he finds it beautiful. He's talking about her eyes, her hair. He's singing about her teeth then in chapter 4, verse 2. Again, it's not that flattering. He's just impressed that there are not very many gaps in her teeth. But, you know, this is the time before dentists. You don't really expect people to have a matching set of teeth. It's the time before toothpaste. You don't really expect that fresh, clean whiteness. But that's what he's describing. And it goes on. Her temples, her neck, her breasts. As his eyes wander down her, and he sings about her. He sings actually about seven parts of her body. And in Hebrew poetry, that number seven means perfect. It means complete. He's really saying she's a 10 out of 10, as far as he's concerned. And he sums that up, doesn't he, in verse 7. You are altogether beautiful. My darling, there is no flaw in you. Now, I don't know if you remember in chapter 1, she wasn't so sure that she had the right look. She was a little bit defensive about it, perhaps. The sophisticated girls in the city, you know, they had what was fashionable at the time, and she didn't really look like that. So I'm guessing this is not a girl who would expect to find herself on the front cover of a fashion magazine. She didn't feel that she was beautiful. But it doesn't matter to him. To him, as he looks at her with love, she's altogether perfect. And people like to say, well, that's because love is blind. But perhaps it's because love sees more clearly, not confused and distracted by the passing whims of what other people might think is fashionable or attractive for no real reason. Not always comparing the one that you love with all the other images that we see. Can you imagine Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and they see each other naked? She is the first woman he has ever seen at all, and certainly the first woman he's seen naked. And for him, from that moment on, she is the definition of perfect beauty. And he's not living in a culture where half naked or fully naked people are constantly there in really to sell us things through advertising and to get our money from us. And that's how he sees beauty. And I guess what I want us to notice is that sex is about beauty. It's a beautiful thing. It's a good thing to sing about. You might not like, as a Christian, you might not like everything about Ed Sheeran's song, but the basic idea that he's in love with the shape of her and wants to sing about it is there in the Bible. And it's a good thing. And it's a right thing. And too often, I guess, we see ourselves and our world messing up in this area and getting things wrong, and so we become negative about it, and the message that we communicate is a wagging finger, a thou shalt not. But actually, Christians in the Bible, we don't have a view of sex that is really low. We're not saying it's a dirty, bad thing. We have a view that is much higher than our culture and sees it as something much more valuable and more precious. Not just a bodily urge, but something deeply beautiful. What is sex about? It's about beauty, first of all. And then secondly, it's about marriage. You could take that from the whole of the song, but I want us to look at the next part. It's about marriage, chapter 4, verse 8 continues. Let me read it from verse 9. You've stolen my heart. My sister, my bride, you have stolen my heart. With one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume more than any spice. He's started to speak about her as his bride. We saw at the end of chapter 3, we were singing about the day of his wedding. And now for the first time in the song, for the only time in the song, he's calling her his bride 5 times in this chapter so that we don't miss it. And only in this chapter. The chapter that is most clearly about sex is also the chapter that is most clearly about marriage. And he describes her love as a wonderful garden, full of all the very best fruits, the finest fragrant perfumes. But up until now, that garden has been locked. Chapter 4, verse 12. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. It is locked up. It's enclosed. It's sealed. He is singing about her virginity. Up until this point, up until the time when the wedding day and he calls her his bride, up until that time, he is not allowed in there. And neither was anyone else. It was a locked garden. And twice in the song already, we've heard her say to her friends, wait, do not awaken love. And now she says, it's time for love to be awakened. Now is the time after the wedding. There it is in chapter 4, verse 16. Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, and blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread everywhere. Let my beloved come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. Notice there, let my beloved come into his garden. It's been a locked garden. It's been locked from him, but actually it's been locked for him. So that now it is his garden. We've seen in the song already, she is his, he is hers. And it's been kept for him to enjoy and him alone. Here in Cambridge, we're used to locked gardens. If you go looking around a Cambridge college, you soon realise that they don't mind the tourists seeing bits that are not so great. But the really nice bit, the master's garden, the dean's garden, is there behind a locked wall. And there's a sign on it saying, no entry, dean's garden, do not walk on the grass and all of that. And this, I think, is a picture of a locked garden with a wall around it. So much so that you don't even really get any air going through. And it's got all the very best and finest fruits and fragrance and flowers in it that you can find anywhere in the world. And it's been kept locked. And you can imagine, you know, when you unseal perfume or aftershave and you open it and the smell first comes out. Well, for the first time, she unlocks that garden and you can picture the breeze and the smell of the flowers and the fruits spreading around for the first time. And she's saying that's what the wedding day is about. That's what sex is about. It's meant to be like that. Kept safe, kept just for him, just for her on the wedding day. It's a locked garden. It's not a muddy, trampled football pitch. You know, that lots of people have been bashing about on and wearing down. It's not a path that's been trodden on by many, many feet in the past. It is a garden for him and for her to enjoy. Chapter 5, verse 1. I have come into my garden, the garden that was locked. He's singing now, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. Do you remember? She said his love was better than wine. He said her love was better than wine. And now the wine has been drunk. The banquet has been eaten. It's not fast food. It's not McDonald's. This is fine food. This is a banquet and a celebration. And then other people are singing. It says the translators have put in friends to give us a clue. Actually, we don't know who it is who's singing. We just know that it's not the two of them. We know it's other people, a group of other people. Could be anyone, could be everyone singing to them. Eat, friends, and drink. Drink your fill of love. It's a little inappropriate for a wedding, maybe, to be singing that. There's a TV comedy series called Jane the Virgin. She is a virgin on her wedding day. This is at the end of the season. She's called Jane the Virgin because she's a virgin. It's, I guess, the end of the story, or the end of one season. It's a romantic church wedding. And they are together at last. And then, you remember, it's a comedy. Then she has this moment of kind of wacky imagination. And she pictures being told, well, you waited, Jane, now go and have sex. and the choir join in and start singing it. Now, Jane, go and have sex. And then, you know, there's a little solo from the in-laws, and there's a kind of elderly member of the family who stands up and sings, and everybody's singing, now go and have sex, Jane. And it's all very awkward and very silly. It's a comedy. Now, I don't think I'm going to be suggesting that we have that as one of the songs that we introduce at weddings at St. Matthew's. But there is a song a bit like that here. In more poetic language, the world is saying to this couple, now they're married, eat and drink your fill of love. And there is something in the Bible about, you know, we tend to think romantic love is just the man and the woman, it's just nothing to do with anybody else. What they want to do behind closed doors is up to them. But marriage is saying that two people come together and the whole community are celebrating with them. And the two lives are joining, not just the bodies, but the lives. And everybody is witnessing the commitment that they're making to each other. Because it is intended to be a public, permanent commitment. And that is the right place for a sexual relationship. We're all used to body language. If you're driving a car, and you get something wrong and you make another driver angry, you can see them behind their window and you can't hear what it is they're shouting, but you can tell from their body language exactly how they feel about you. They manage to communicate that very clearly without having to say anything out loud. We're used to body language. Our body language is one of the ways that we communicate. And sex is the ultimate body language. It says, I have nothing to hide from you. I'm completely open with you. I'm sharing everything with you. And I'm one with you. It's pretty obvious, really, that that's what it's communicating. It's a bit like in a wedding, in a marriage service. The couples say to each other, all that I have, I share with you. All that I am, I give to you. That's what sex is communicating. And I guess we try sometimes to make it less than that. We think of it as just an urge, just wanting perhaps to take something from the other person. We try to sort of make it not mean that. Perhaps to even agree in a conversation, look, this doesn't really mean anything. We may say that with our words, but our bodies are not saying that. And our hearts can tell. It's always difficult when a relationship doesn't work out and breaks up. It's always painful. But so much more so when it's been a sexual relationship. And there is a danger, isn't there, that people will train themselves over time to separate the way that we feel from what we're doing. And to separate our bodies and to empty sex of any sense of intimacy or connection or commitment. Or oneness, and the currency is devalued. And we've made it much, much less than God made it to be. And I'm not sure it will ever fully work trying to do that. What is sex about? Well, in God's design, it's about beauty. It's a beautiful thing. Secondly, it's about marriage. And what else? Well, thirdly, and perhaps this might surprise you, thirdly, it's about Christ. Seems like a strange thing to say. It's about Christ. We'll look at, we'll see that clearly in Ephesians in a moment. We'll turn to it in a moment. But first, there are already hints of that in the Song of Songs. So love, we've seen, is compared to an amazing garden. So for example, chapter 4, verse 13. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. This is not a garden you would find in this world. It's got the best of every possible fragrance, every kind of fruit that you could find, the most wonderful and beautiful things that the writer has heard of from all over the known world at the time. It's actually the garden that was engraved in the artwork in Solomon's temple. Not on the outside of the temple, on the inside of the temple, the place of God's presence. It's actually a description of the Garden of Eden. You see, we were made to enjoy God's presence in a perfect, unspoiled paradise. But we've all rejected God. We've all turned from him. We've disobeyed him. We've been locked out. The garden is locked now. It's a locked garden. We've been locked out of the Garden of Eden. We've been locked out of God's presence because of our disobedience to him. Locked out of the love we were made to enjoy, the unity, the oneness we were supposed to enjoy with God. It's described as an amazing garden. Love here is described as milk and honey. Did you notice that? Chapter 4, verse 11. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. That's the language that is often used in the Bible for the promised land. The land of milk and honey. The best of everything. God promises that he will... We've been kicked out of his paradise. We've lost his presence. He's promising to bring us back. That's what life is about. It's a journey through a wilderness to a promised land. A place where there is the best of everything. And you may say, well, hang on, that is going a bit far. Surely even the best sex, even the best marriage, even the best relationship can't take you to paradise. People might speak about it that way. It might even feel like that way for a brief time, but not for long. And the song is actually realistic about that too. We've seen a song that has been about longing and now consummation. Well, the next section is about longing again. Even after the wedding day, these couple are talking about separation and pain and longing again. And that's deliberate. Even if we do as this song says, even if we are able to drink our fill of love in this life, nothing in this life is going to fill that need or meet that longing. Not even the best relationship. Not even the best marriage. That longing, that need is there to show us what we really are made to need, a deeper, a better union, not just for a few moments, but for an eternity. That's what Jesus is offering us, to be restored to that perfect presence of God, to be one with him, not just for a time, but forever. Well, let's, as we finish, I just want us to turn to Ephesians 5 in the New Testament, because it sums up this idea that marriage and the unity between a man and a wife is pointing towards Jesus. So it's page 117. No, it's 1176. Yeah, page 1176. Ignore whatever I said before. Page 1176. It's Ephesians chapter 5. I'm just going to read to you from verse 25. Chapter 5, verse 25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated their own body, but they feed and care for their body, just as Christ does the church, for we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. Do you see how he's saying there that the story of the creation of husband and wife and marriage and becoming one flesh, he's saying that's really about Christ and the church, really. That's what it's meant to tell us about. That's what it's about. That, I guess, is why marriage has to be committed. Lifelong, till death do us part. God commits himself to us. And he asks that we commit ourselves to him. That is why marriage in the Bible is between a man and a woman, between like and unlike. That is why there's an element of leadership and submission. All of these things, I know, very controversial for us now, but they're really not about equality and inequality and who is better or worse and how you look after everybody's rights and needs. It's not about that. It's about making a really good picture of Christ and his church. That's what marriage is for. Because Christ is not like us, and we're not like him. And yet he lovingly sacrifices himself for us, out of love for us, dies for us on the cross, and we can fully trust him because of that love. And it's a joy to submit to him. And marriage is intended to be a picture of that. Just as we finish, some of us might be left feeling a sense of failure. I guess all of us have fallen short to some extent in this area. Not living out God's design. Perhaps it's not always been beautiful in our lives. Perhaps some of what we've done and thought and said has made it something more ugly than it was meant to be. Maybe there are things that we would want to hide and feel ashamed of, wouldn't want people to know about. Maybe the garden hasn't been kept locked. Maybe it's sometimes others have been let in when they shouldn't have been. Perhaps even some have forced their way through the gate. And we know what it's like, perhaps, some of us, to be abused against our will. For many people, there'll be the frustration of missing out. This beautiful picture of sex and marriage is hard to listen to if you feel that's not something you expect to have. I was listening to a Christian writer called Vaughan Roberts speak about this. He's been very open about being attracted to people of the same sex in his life, but he's never felt it would be the right thing for him to have a partner, because that's not what the Bible is encouraging. And people say to him, well, you're missing out on the best thing in life. And he says, well, there is a cost to knowing Jesus, but he points out that everyone pays a cost if they want to know Jesus. If you realise that the most wonderful thing in life is to know Christ, Paul says the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ. Everything else is nothing compared to that, he says. And if you realise that, there's always going to be things that you will give up. Different things for different people. But there'll always be a cost, there'll always be a price to put Jesus first in your life. But also, Vaughan Roberts points out that you can actually, you're not missing out on the best thing in life, because sex and relationships only points to the best thing in life. And you can never actually fill that gap or meet that need without Christ. And if you try to do that in other ways, if you go looking for something else to fill that gap and meet that need, you're only going to feel more empty than before. All of us, he says, are frustrated in this life. All of us are longing for the next life. And so we are to picture a wedding day that we are all invited to take part in. And the words are said to Jesus, Saviour, will you take this sinner to be your bride? And he never says no. He says, I will. And the words are said to us, to each of us, sinner, will you take this Saviour to be yours? And many say, well, I don't really know if he would want me or have me. I am a sinner. I'm not worthy. I have messed up. Maybe it's been in relationships and sex. Maybe it's been in some other way. My life has not been beautiful, we say. And he says, well, I can sort that out. I can fix that. I can make you beautiful. I can make you the perfect bride. That's why I died for you. So for all of us who feel we failed in this area or any other, it's never too late to say to Jesus, I do. And the invitation is there for all of us. Come and drink our fill of his love.